Malcolm Homeline is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update here on a Friday morning at JM in the AM. Mr. Homeline, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Hey, good morning.
And just when you thought that there's so much big news in this world, and believe you me, there is, folks, there's a lot going on in many different countries that we have to discuss. But Mr. Homeline is using this radio program to break what might be even bigger news, and that is on October the 15th at the Waldorf Astoria in New York City. That's right, October 15th of 2013, the 50th anniversary dinner of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations will take place, an opportunity to pay tribute and support their amazing work. Guests of honor include the 20 past chairman of the Conference of Presidents, since there has not been a gathering like this in two decades, and of course Mr. Homeline himself, who will be a guest of honor that evening. It's happening at the Waldorf on October the 15th, and Malcolm, I guess what we should say is everybody should circle their calendar for the big event.
Circle the wagons and the calendar for this event. It's the first dinner we've done in 20 years, as you said, and all the chairmen from that period and myself are being focused on, but it's really a tribute to all of the people who have done so much to make the work of the conference and its organizations and its creations possible. And it's not something we do, will not do for another 20 years again, but this is a very important opportunity. We've launched many new programs fighting BDS and delegitimization, Iran, the lawfare projects, the America's Voices, the trips to Israel, the secure community network, dealing with security communities, and all these things take money. And when you have a small budget, every once in a while we have to catch up. So this is catch-up time.
Information, will there be a website? Will there be a phone number? Will there be an invite list? How's this going to work?
All of the above. There will be a website soon. People can go to the conferenceofpresidents.org. I think that there's something there now, but certainly they can always call the conference office at 212-318-6111, 212-318-6111, and we will send out the invitations as soon as they're ready.
Is it true that you'll be coming here to the radio station in advance of the dinner to rank the best chair people with me on the air, to sort of do a top 10 of the most effective chair men and women over the last two decades?
Could be.
I am preparing my side of the list, trying to think of those who've been really nice to me over the years.
Well, actually, I think that they've all been generally very good and very committed people, really remarkable.
Come on, Malcolm. There are some that have shown more than others. S-H-O-N-E.
Oh, right.
There are those who have been superstars compared to some of the others. Come on.
Oh, I think I'll let you rank them then.
You don't want to start naming names, I see. All right, a lot of news this week, quite obviously, and a lot of our listeners are familiar because it's made the headlines, and this news story they actually do report in depth at length, and I'm referring, of course, to the coup, if we call it that, in Egypt. Let's start with you giving us the absolute latest in terms of what's happening in Egypt, then we'll talk about Israel, U.S. reaction, etc. What's the latest from Egypt?
Well, today is Friday, and this is the day the Islamists have proclaimed to be a day for demonstrations. The word is that they're going to march on the defense ministry. Their headquarters is not far from it, and obviously because it was the minister of defense and the generals who took control and who are today arresting some 300 of the top leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood. Many are in jail already, including Morsi, who was transferred from his home to a prison in Cairo. I think this is a move to try and prevent them from inciting violence and from perpetuating the problems, but they will do it anyway. They even arrested the supreme guide, Badi, and his deputy, El-Shater, whom we've talked about, who is considered one of the most powerful, probably, of the people in the Muslim Brotherhood, so that the army is acting really in a broad way. All the TV stations, the four TV stations controlled by the Muslim Brotherhood, have been closed down. They have taken a number of other steps against them. The tensions spread, and we will talk about later, but about the Sinai and Gaza, where tanks are moving. But inside Egypt itself, you still have the demonstrations by the people supporting the army. You will have probably a large counter-demonstration. But Fridays was traditionally the days when the Muslim Brotherhood, because the Islamists go to the mosque in the morning. They put in the interim the chief judge, Mansour, in as president, but people are already coming out and declaring their intention to run. And it could well be that the Muslim Brotherhood will regroup and run again. This is not the destruction of the party. But I think it does put into context something we've said, and that is that they probably are not more than 20 or 25% of the population, even though the initial election results, which was more anti-Mubarak and not pro-Muslim Brotherhood, but they won't go away. They're gonna be there, like the Mubarak supporters, and how they manifest themselves in participating or non-participation, whether they engage in violence now is going to be a test. Egypt has to get focused on rebuilding the economy, and there's no indication that anybody has any plans, and think that this all cost them also. Many days of strike cost them even more money.
And I could imagine. Without hitting the streets, this never could have happened, correct? I mean, this is
absolutely
the only way would have been, the only way to have accomplished this would be democratically, or something close to democratically elected.
And the feeling was that you were not going to have a democratic election under Morsi. Look, the Muslim Brotherhood has a nationwide structure. There was nobody else who had. Now you see the people finally coming out in large numbers. The last time it was less than 1 million people who participated.
And it's so much more this time?
It's much, much more. Many more cities, more activity, and still the vast majority have not participated.
The images seem less violent. Is that just a perception?
No, I think that is correct. It is less violent. The army clearly was given instructions not to. They remember they flew over Tahrir Square flying flags, not shooting the Mubarak troops. The army under Mubarak was given orders to shoot. They didn't. They could have done it right away. They didn't. But later on, they killed and hundreds of people died. Here, you see the numbers are more limited, although the number of wounded is increasing.
Why do people feel it's necessary to stay on the streets at this point?
Well, first it was to express relief and to celebrate. Remember, they've imposed increasingly strict Islamist legislation, but most of all it's about the economy and the feeling that also the Muslim Brotherhood was increasingly taking control, putting their people in every key position, including the army, or attempting to do so. This is the leadership they brought into the army. Al-Sisi was not a Mubarak person. He was brought in by Morsi, but the rank and file has not yet switched. They were in the process of trying to replace the officer corps, the people, the cadets in the officer training schools, which may have backfired on them as well. They may have gone too far with arresting people like the General Guide and others, because that will excite the Muslim Islamist Brotherhood more. Also, to think about the implications in other countries where Muslim Brotherhood won, whether this will affect them as well.
A good example of that would be
Tunisia, Libya, Morocco, if it discredits them, Jordan, where they're fighting to take control, other countries in Syria.
Not to oversimplify things, but what does it say about a country when they do, in fact, elect somebody, unless there was massive voter fraud, but they do, in fact, elect somebody, you know, and legitimately someone is put in with the majority of votes among the voting public, and then a year later they're ready to kill the guy, basically.
Well, it says a couple of things, actually. One, about the process of the first election, which was a reaction to Mubarak's overthrow, where the Muslim Brotherhood was the only organized party. They were the only ones in a position to field national candidates. They used the mosques to organize. And if you notice the trend of the different elections subsequent to the first one, they went down each time, significantly, in fact. So the number of the votes they got can't be ascribed to Muslim Brotherhood alone. It was a protest vote. It was a vote for change. It was a vote for something new. These guys promised an end to corruption. They promised improving the economy. And in fact, the Muslim Brotherhood was not prepared for it. They had no experience in doing it. They didn't anticipate, I think, all of the problems. But the it's an accidental presidency because it wasn't their intention to win it initially, and then
On top of that, they delivered on nothing.
And they delivered on absolutely not one single promise, except the fact that they increased the Islamist agenda, advanced the Islamist agenda. There is no infrastructure for governance in Egypt today. You need a nationwide structure that can sustain a country of 80 million people. It's huge, and 50% making less than $2 a day. No hope. Tourism, which provided 10% of the economy, destroyed. The exports destroyed. The Suez Canal endangered. That's why the price of oil shot up, because Egypt doesn't really export oil. A little bit of gas, but no oil. But it's because of the endangering people's fears that the transport through the Suez Canal could be endangered.
Well, not that I'm overly concerned, but what does this do now to the Muslim Brotherhood? I mean, this must be a big hit for them, you know, internationally, not just in Egypt.
That's exactly right, and that's what I was alluding to. And you have to see the reaction, you know, for how long we've talked and tried to get people to look at the broader issues and not see just the narrow developments in the Middle East, but to understand that what we're seeing is not simply Muslim Brotherhood emerging. This is about a Sunni-Shiite war. This is about control of the region. This is about economy. This is about failed states. It's about so many things. It's about now Russia versus the United States. It's about Iran versus Turkey. All of these sub-themes run through every one of these conflicts as well. And you see it in the way the king of Saudi Arabia, the king himself, congratulated the Egyptians for overthrowing the Muslim Brotherhood because they hate them. The Qataris poured in almost $5 billion into Egypt, and now they have a new ruler. We're going to have to see what they will do. Iraqis supported the revolution. The Iranians mourned the fall of Morsi because they've invested a lot with him, and of course talk about conspiracies and
What about the Syrians?
And then blamed him for failing to control the military. Turkey said that they were anti-democratic.
Syria?
Even though Turkey had reached out to Egypt and Erdogan to so they criticized the revolution as anti-democratic because he had reached out to Morsi. So you see the split in the region.
What about Syria?
So Syria has come out very much in favor of the fall of the Muslim Brotherhood because they broke relations with Syria and because the Muslim Brotherhood is fighting with the rebel forces against Assad.
So basically, it's really the Iranians and maybe Turkey that are not happy with the developments in Egypt.
Who have so far... And Iraq is split.
Right. Oh, it is split.
It is split. And remember that Iraq's leader is becoming more and more an Iranian operation, but the people are not. So you have a real division in Iraq. Jordan, obviously, will be... The king of Jordan will be very pleased. The Muslim Brotherhood in Jordan will be very unhappy.
Right. America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning Radio program. Heard on listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope. Around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Egypt, as we surmised, dominating the early part of our conversation this week on the weekly update. Malcolm Honlein is with us live via telephone. All right, there are so many, and maybe I'm just reading the wrong or certain types of commentators, but there are a lot of people who don't like the wishy-washiness that's coming out of Washington. And I know the president is in a very tough spot. You don't know who to support, and you don't know how things are going to end up, no matter who you support. But it seemed like he was sort of giving this, they're going to lose the game but beat the point spread type thing. Like, you know, I'm supporting Morsi, but I'm very concerned that he take the protesters' concerns very seriously. Didn't it look and appear that the president of the United States was taking a real hybrid position on this?
Well, there have been so many reports about the activities, for instance, of the ambassador, Ann Patterson, who is scheduled or reported to be getting a very high position in State Department dealing with the Middle East. Now it's not clear at all that she'll get it, that she had called in the cops and others and urged them not to participate in the anti-Morsi demonstrations. Then when it became clear that that Morsi was not going to last, the U.S. came out and urged, earlier urged him to be more accepting of the of the message of the street and
right.
to try to accommodate. And then, of course, now about a transition, but they're urging them to go right away to civilian elections and get rid of the military, when in fact, sometimes you need a military, you need a strong leadership to get things stable, and the military tended to be more pro-Western. So it's a difficult position. They are meeting on it, I know, at the every night, and spent a lot of time trying to get a handle on it. Again, it's one of those situations which, you know, whatever they do is going to be wrong, but there were things they could have done earlier, and we became too closely associated with Morsi, or seemed to be backing Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood by statements from the administration and positions they took, etc. And, you know, the United States is going to be put in a tough position. You used the word coup. If this, in fact, is a military coup, that automatically cuts off all the aid.
Right.
The African Union is suspending Egypt as a member because it's a coup. So the United States is saying, well, it's not really a coup, because they can therefore continue. But I think that arms sales, which is the bulk of it, $1.3 billion, was front-loaded, meaning they've already paid it all. And the economic aid as well, which is about $250 million, plus other assistance.
So they keep talking about USAID having to be suspended. It doesn't matter. At this point, it may all be there already.
Well, it may be there for now, but it does affect next year. And the question is, if it's not a coup, then it's not automatic.
Yeah. Would any other, and I'm not doing the Republican-Democratic thing, would other presidents have handled this differently? Would we have seen a president of the United States who may have supported Mubarak at the very beginning of this entire process and helped him gain control of the country at that point? Or is this, you know, I'm trying to get at it, is this an acceptable way of dealing with it when you're the largest power in the world?
Well, I think you can't attribute it just to one administration, because I think there's a screw-up in U.S. policy over time, but I think it's been exacerbated, and certainly in the Arab world, everybody raises the issue of how Mubarak was treated. Not the support for Mubarak, but the fact about how the U.S. abandoned him, and that's one of the things that motivates Putin, as I pointed out, is
right.
that he's showing that he's loyal to his friends, even if it's costing him politically, and the appearance that the United States, whether it was in Syria and other places, you know, was indecisive, hasn't the West generally not making decisions or reacting in ways that were not the most appropriate. I can tell you in the Gulf and other places, there's a great deal of anger, and the almost absence of the United States from a lot of the developments in the region or being ahead of the issues. But they are complex, and many times, you know, it appears that there was an obvious thing to do, but the obvious thing may not be the right thing.
How does the U.S. repair its image then? Or there's really no way to backtrack at this point?
At this point, it's going to be very hard, seriously, very hard, because we give all this aid, we get nothing for it, we get no credit for it in the countries, and we get certainly not from the regimes often. Morsi did play the game. He turned over the relationship with Israel because he knew it's a very sensitive issue in the United States, and especially in Congress and the administration, which pressed them on the issue often and about what they were doing in Gaza. He turned it essentially over to the army so that he didn't get blamed, and he could, you know, say it's the army dealing with it and it's a security matter. And the security cooperation was really good. And certainly in recent months, it was even better. But it was sustained over the time. They obviously didn't do all we would have wanted in terms of closing tunnels, but lately they were doing them. They closed hundreds of them for their own reasons. But now, in advance of what's happened, tanks were moved into the Sinai and to the Gaza borders. The borders have been closed. The Rafah crossing was closed by the Egyptians. They are very concerned because there were four attacks in the southern Sinai near El Arish. And the army moved right away tanks into the region because Sinai itself is a no man's land. It's lawless. It's filled with Islamic Jihad terrorists and Al-Qaeda and other groups. And the fear that they could organize, they killed some Egyptian soldiers. They attacked police stations and other locations. They used rockets against the airport, which is a military airport in the Sinai. So,
but the pretense of moving those troops in could not have had anything to do with Israel, right? It was just to quell whatever...
I don't know. It's, They needed Israel's permission to do it. So, of course, you know, the anti-Israel guys who are always looking for an excuse to jump on it will say, "Well, you see, it's a conspiracy because Israel agreed, etc." And you know, and for Israel, this is obviously a major concern. We've seen the rebuilding of Hamas's military capacity. It's estimated they again have 5,000 rockets, some of them medium range that can hit Tel Aviv, even Jerusalem. But this is a blow to Hamas, which was depending on the Muslim Brotherhood to benefit it and to be more sympathetic and supportive, especially vis-a-vis the...
Is it a blow to Hezbollah as well, or that's unrelated?
It's less related, but it's not unrelated. Hezbollah itself is taking hits because of their involvement in Syria. But anything that shows popular movements against Islamist groups affects any of them. And in Lebanon, there is growing dissatisfaction and mounting anger at Hezbollah because of dragging them into this war in Syria, showing that he's really not a liberator. You know, he's the same kind of petty politician with the same corruption, etc., and a stooge of Iran being their agent in fighting in Syria. That does not play well in a lot of Lebanon.
At any point in the last week, when you were analyzing what was happening with the American response to Egypt, did you say now we can learn what we should be saying regarding Syria? Like, is there any comparison here where one can say now that we've learned this lesson from Egypt, we should apply the same thing in terms of American reaction to Syria?
Well, one of the lessons you learn generally is that this assumption that the Muslim Brotherhood represents the popular feeling and popular opinion and it's what people really want, and everybody kept saying, you know, you have to understand this is the direction, this is what they want to do. It tells us this is not what the popular opinion is, and I bet in Syria, which is even more secular, that will be true as well, and that we don't have to cut them a lot of slack. We don't have to, you know, enable them to be an equal player or a significant player. We should be helping to shut them out and shut them down. Obviously, for the rebels, they're not the first target now, but we should be looking a step ahead, especially when you have groups like al-Nusra, and the United States is concerned about it. And I'm not saying this is something they're not worried about, but we have to look at it. And the same thing is true in terms of Turkey and other places that you know, we ascribe the Muslim Brotherhood victories as expressions of the people, and while they may win an election, it doesn't mean that it's truly a democratic expression.
Assuming the Twitter news feed I saw is accurate, shots were fired overnight at an Israeli patrol on the Syrian border. This is a question I've been asking you now for 3-4 weeks in a row in terms of activity on the Syrian border. Anything special, quote-unquote, about this episode?
No. And no real build-up on the Syrian front. It's something Israel's always concerned about. It's watching it all the time now. You know, you notice how Syria has disappeared from public attention, not because the fighting has diminished, but how that the media can't handle two stories at once. It's really quite remarkable when you think about how intensive all the fighting, everything there is, and essentially no attention. When the Secretary of State met in a peace conference, to talk about the Syrian peace conference with the foreign minister of Russia, Lavrov, in Brunei, it got almost no coverage, and yeah. I don't think much came of it, and it doesn't look like the peace conference, even if it materializes, will mean much, but I'm not even sure that it can materialize.
What do we know about
Russians blaming Russian TV, blaming the U.S. for what's going on there? And the Christians fleeing and more worried about their future.
And I'll get back to that in a moment. What do we know about the Jewish American who was killed in the protests in Egypt?
It seems that he was an innocent bystander. He was a Jewish student active in Hillel who was there on an exchange program or a study abroad program and was outside during the fighting and got caught between the various forces and was killed.
You just mentioned
it
about...
It doesn't appear that he was the target.
Right.
So far.
You just mentioned about Russia. All of this, because we again this morning we see in the news a German reaction. Merkel is looking with a very suspicious eye to the United States regarding the the spy case that continues to be exposed, what the U.S. has known about so many different countries because of Snowden, etc. You just mentioned the Soviet Union a moment ago. Soviet Union. You just mentioned Russia a moment ago. That takes you back, huh, Malcolm? Mentioned Russia a moment ago, and I'm sure that the Snowden situation only exacerbates Russian attitude and Putin's attitude toward Washington. Would you say that because of the spy case being in the headlines still, it only makes this whole situation more complicated?
It makes our international relations more complicated, even if not directly this situation, until they come out with more information. And you notice, till now, Israel has not been mentioned as having been a target.
And that is because?
They may not have gotten to it yet.
Meaning that not a target of our intelligence agencies?
Well, we certainly know that it is a target like other countries, but
so why wouldn't it have
been mentioned as one of the countries that were covered? But
oh, not gotten to it, meaning the exposure of it has
right,
not
but
gotten
he hasn't yet. Released most of the information, and they say there's very explosive stuff that's still coming. That could be a bargaining chip, but it has impacted, and it's taken away one of the issues the United States has used about foreign surveillance, especially China's hacking, etc. This sort of diminishes it. It undermines America's moral standing and position. The anger, I think, is somewhat exaggerated, and it's mostly not directed at the fact that we're doing it, but the scale at which we were doing it, that it wasn't targeted to some particular threat to the United States, but seems to have been a massive, much more massive operation. We'll find out whether that's true, and, you know, when you live in an age of terrorism, steps, extraordinary steps are necessary, but this seems to be way beyond what people so far have been able to justify.
Right, so aside from Putin's loyalty to leadership in Syria, if the U.S. would make an argument that ethically the right thing to do would be to abandon, then they would retort, you want to speak about ethics, you know, in terms...
And also, they rebel in anything that puts the United States down. And when the United States standing generally in international community is not particularly high, or and especially given all of the issues that we've discussed, this further undermines it and gives fodder to the others to say, you think they're a democracy? You see what they do? They spy on their friends. They undermine the security of countries.
By the way, is this accurate? Listeners this week claimed, I didn't see this, that's why I'm putting it on their shoulders, claimed that when the President of the United States landed in Senegal, there were anti-Semitic, anti-Zionist, anti-Israel signs greeting him. Is that true?
Did you? I did not.
Would it be a believable story in African nations?
Everything is believable. You have large Muslim population, and you can have it anywhere. It's interesting, in Egypt, by and large, you've had very little or almost none, except at the university in Cairo, where they were yelling Khaybar, which I discussed, if you remember, a couple weeks ago, that the Egyptians made a film called Khaybar that's going to start showing during Ramadan. That is the place in 620 where Muhammad wiped out a Jewish community in Saudi Arabia, and is related in the Quran, but used usually as a cover example for what should be done to Israel. They did yell Khaybar, Khaybar, and that's Israel. And of course, everybody, including Erdogan, repeatedly in Turkey and others, officials in Turkey, people in Syria, and now in Egypt, resort to the conspiracy theories and blame outside forces for what's happening. And of course, talk about the Jewish lobby and others when it's just so ludicrous, and yet people buy it.
All right, so there's no reason not to believe that it could have happened while he was being greeted in Africa as well. And finally, the Kerry shuttle. Would you agree with me that news reports over the last 7 days since we last spoke seem to indicate a real spring in Kerry's step? He thinks that within a few minutes, he can have a peace negotiation completely restarted between Israel and the PA.
I don't think that he thinks that he's got a deal brewing. He wants to keep it alive. He wants the process to be alive. I think Israel wants the process to be alive, and Israel has indicated repeatedly their readiness to come to the table. And Abbas, as we expected, is playing his old games, both with, in terms of preconditions, and basically just doesn't want to come to the table. He doesn't want to have to negotiate. I think the Egyptian developments take some pressure off him on one hand, and if it weakens Hamas, that also changes. He doesn't feel the pressure of having to compete with Hamas when it is weakened and its major supporters now removed, and we don't know what will happen in the future. So he may feel less pressure today to have to reach an accord. And at his age, he probably feels that if he can wait it out and doesn't have to make any concessions. So you might get some sort of a symbolic gathering out of this. But clearly the secretary did not get what he wanted, and he did some quick shuttle diplomacy.
Does it look bad when he's spending all his time on this issue when there are so many other places the United States Secretary of State should be concentrating their efforts right now?
No, I don't think it looks bad for him. I think it's an attempt the United States and the Europeans and everybody, you know, gives the United States leeway to do this. But the fact they don't have results, and he is putting the onus on Abbas from all the reports. But people will say, you know, we've got Syria, we've got Egypt, and we have to focus on those things. If you have a reluctant Palestinian leadership, then let them stew in their own juices and move to other things. But I don't think anybody wants to see him abandon the effort completely, because if you do, A, it invites the Europeans and everybody else to do stuff which will be more detrimental. B, it gives cover for those who want to go back to Intifada-like activities. Not, I don't believe an Intifada is coming, but look at the statistics for the number of kidnappings, the increase in violence, and the success of the Israeli forces and intelligence agencies in thwarting it. But the fact is that you've had a sharp increase in it.
Wow, unbelievable. All right, Monday begins the 9 days, Malcolm, and putting things in historical perspective, we have to remember to strike a balance, meaning obviously we have an obligation to remember the past, and certainly the halachic obligation to build up to the saddest day of the year. At the same time, I'm always happy when you remind everybody that we should remember where we stand now in Jewish history, a lot better off than most of our previous generations.
And well, the things that we tend to take for granted, and the debates we have over Israel these days, when the fundamental fact of 150,000 people learning full time that you have a Jewish state with a Jewish army that is able to protect Jews around the world, that the lesson of the 9 days and of Tisha B'Av was a lack of achdus. And we're seeing it again, and this rends the people apart. And frankly, to me, it's the greatest danger we face, more than a nuclear Iran or more than a Muslim Brotherhood.
Yep.
It is the divisions within the community, and we'll talk more about it.
Oh, we certainly will. All right, a reminder, if you missed the opening of this conversation, circle your calendars on the 15th of October. We have a chance for some unity, right, Malcolm? It'll be a night of unity. Well, am I right or wrong that you will have members of our community of all types of backgrounds there that night for the big Conference of Presidents dinner?
Every stripe of every kind of Jew will be there.
I have a chance to sit at a table with people from all different areas of Jewish life. How do you like that?
All over the world.
How do you like that? I don't know how I'll be sitting at a table, if I'll be chairing the event, but, you know. It's the 50th anniversary dinner of the Conference of Presidents, and the guests of honor, in addition to Mr. Honlein, are the 20 chair people who have served in the capacity over the last two decades, since that was the last public recognition during a dinner celebration of the accomplishments of the conference chairs. It's happening October the 15th. All the information through the website and phone number of the Conference of Presidents, and as Malcolm said earlier, invitations are coming soon. Mr. Honlein, have a wonderful show. I think we're on next week, right? 9 days? We have no reason not to be on, right?
Absolutely. All right. Every reason to be on.
Every reason to be on is right. All right. Malcolm will join us next week for yet another installment of the Weekly Update. He is the Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.